Forgive us, dear audience, for starting this podcast in the usual introduction format. This accursed box, the entertainment shorthand of the lazy faux formalist. This is one that I'm sure you are ever familiar with. It is common for hosts to use this sequence to declare themselves the voice of their generation, to state that we have progressed past those men before us, whom we have learned all the wrong lessons. Minor hosts never attempt to change the world. They only ever rearrange the pieces, each time hoping for something new and hopeful to emerge from their dialogue. But these minor podcast hosts are not alone to blame for the current state of affairs. We, the listeners, you and I, allow ourselves to be charmed by this flagrant self-promotion. It is not that the introduction is important, but that it reminds us of importance. We confuse the podcast for the very thing it is examining. So here we are, with our opinions laid bare before us. Shall we discard them all together? An attempt to create something new? You and I, a team in telling the audience which book to read. You, the living listener, and I, merely a dead podcast host. Forgive me, friend. We are at the opening of our show. I am still stretching my vocal cords. Win wise with Wisconsin. They tend to become muddled. We may have some growing pains, such as the price of the newfound trust between us. Wait a moment. Is there trust between us? We have entered into an agreement without knowing one thing about you. You don't strike us as the type to read comics, gay, adolescent power fantasies, socialist, didactic polyemics, or politically neutral stories written by English warlocks. You seem, by your continued presence here, on our channel, something more than that. Something more than the most vile of creatures, the casual listener. So let us unite. Let us cast aside all notion of what was. Let us be reborn in a world of tribute. Let us together, my, you, our dearest, newest friend, cast something original. Well, thank you very much, Henry Henry. And welcome, everybody, to Outside the Panels in our first White Noise Vault Spotlight. Me, as always, is Michael, also known as Poet Air, and joining me today to dissect this meta-literal masterpiece experience, as always, is...
Got Chaz, also known as Chaz Simons over here, very excited to confront my fears and author my own tale alongside our other co-hostess with the co-mostess, as I believe your bio said, Blake.
Yeah, I'm BT Morgan on BT Morgan 85 on Twitter, probably. That's what I think it is, and Instagram. And yeah, we're going to take you on a wild literature ride with our fourth podcast genius.
Synesthetic, a.k.a. Jack.
And well, we all know I'm obsessed with White Noise, and this is really, and once again, let's get into the who the creative team is. This is written by Ryan O'Sullivan. It is drawn by Andrea Muti, colors by Vladimir Popov, and the lettering by Ann World Design, who is a lettering unit. And this is Ryan, and I know that Ryan and Dan and many of the White Noise boys, I think Ryan, Dan, and Ram, all met in college literature classes in college. And this is definitely Ryan flexing those college literal muscles and deconstructing not only comic books, but deconstructing literature itself. And he gets to kind of take all his little pieces he's got from James Joyce, from William Shakespeare, and many other authors, especially Joseph Campbell, to create this meta-narrative insanity which I absolutely love. And Henry is a sociopath, and we basically are interacting with the book. As Henry puts it, everything in the book only happens because we're reading it. And so we are basically the accomplice to the terrible things he's going to commit throughout the book. And it all starts with one of my favorite things is he's shitting on Alan Moore and Alan Moore's creation of the 9-grid panel, which many comics use. Another comic we'll be talking about very soon had a lot of 9-panel work that Alan Moore created. And that's how the book starts out. And he promises to create something original, which, he, love it or not love this book, it's one of the most original things you will ever read or experience. And off that point, we could say that Henry is a editor that edits for a famous fantasy novelist, and he translates also to different languages, where he is known to do his own translations and change it for other countries.
I was going to say, I think that's where his editing comes in, really. He's, I believe, hired solely to do translations, but he comments that it's a vast improvement on the original text, because, of course, he knows. He's that much better. He's that much smarter than the average layperson. So yeah, I didn't pick up that he was an editor in anything other than his own mind.
I think you are right, but I mean, he is an editor in his own mind because he's editing every single book he's translating from other countries, which would be a great add-on. Maybe
even editing this story as we read it, being the unreliable narrator and sociopath that he is. We experience the events of this book solely through his perspective, whether we want it or not. There were a lot of times, actually. I definitely concede your point that love it or hate it, this is a... Well, I won't say hate it. Love it or not love it, right? Love it or like it, this is a very wholly... not wholly unique, but a very well-done take on that deconstruction idea of exploring the metaphysical nature of the story and the reader, in that we control and are complicit because we want to see this through to the end, everything that happens in the
and
book.
It gets right in the beginning when he's talking to his editor Wolfgang, where it's not his real name, he gives him a name, and I love that his own editing and unreliability. He says in him in the beginning, don't take this as a dismissal or a sign of dislike for him. My agent was a dear friend. And then the next page, he says, dear reader, you must forgive me. I've caught up in the romance of our beginning in this tale together. I've never liked my agent. He is a swine of the highest order, a failed writer who, to make up for his own severe lack of it, basically has become an editor. And to get in the story is... The editor tells him, why am I going to take a book from you when Arthur has a manuscript that is done? And that puts Henry on a journey to steal the manuscript.
Yeah, did he? Did he really steal it?
Gets him.
Well, hold on. Not steal. He just wants to take a peek. That's all.
At least according to him.
He just wanted to see a little bit. Maybe that would be the rain on his garden that would flower these stories within him.
Well, and he very much says that Wolfgang was the one, you know, basically saying the steal it, because why else would he tell him about the manuscript lying there?
Right.
And a thing you'll notice about Henry is he loves to place blame on everyone besides himself. And then that gets him confused with Arthur Proctor by the muse. And that's the muse from William Shakespeare, who there is a other realm called the Fearscape, which are humanity's greatest fears manifest, and they change throughout time and throughout history, depending on what the greatest fear is. One of my favorite side characters, Francesco Petrarch, who was an old hero that was chosen by the muse. His greatest fear was just a rat that he had to kill because he was living in plague times. And he is introduced to this world of the Fearscape and to the gate of the grave of the poets. And through that, he gets to meet some of literature's, you know, like the hero of a thousand faces from Joseph Campbell and many William Shakespeare characters in the Fearscape. And it kind of just goes all the way from there. It's very meta. We are interacting and helping the story go through. And basically, it's a descent in his character because Henry Henry is not a likable character. And it's his journey through the Fearscape and doing worse and worse things because, as to not getting too much into it right away, I want to have everyone else's thoughts. Blake, being a college lit person, what are your thoughts on this book? Because I know we talked about it a lot, and I love how you say it's an experience.
Yeah, it definitely, you don't just read it, you participate in it. I think it's got a pretty big commentary just on storytelling in general, for both sides, for both the person writing it, the characters making it, and the person, you know, witnessing it as a, you know, a reader or participant. You know, it's storytelling is the great lie, and I think we get a lot of that throughout the whole book because we were constantly lied to and manipulated.
It's like a bad relationship, this thing was. And then yeah, I kept going really, back because really I was like, what? It was like checking in on an ex on Instagram or something where you're like, I got to know that I'm doing better than Henry Henry. But he just keeps lying to me.
Definitely. Yeah, you don't feel appreciated.
He tries to make you feel appreciated, doesn't he? Dear reader, thou art my friend.
I like how he starts with apologizing, like early in the novel. He's like, dear reader, I apologize. And then later on, or in the novel, in the graphic novel, but later on, he's like, oh, reader, you're a part of this too. And then later he's like, oh, this is actually your fault, not mine. I'm not the bad person. It's you.
Yeah, he just says that this couldn't have happened without you. You turning the page is what has created this to happen, which is, I love he's so meta literal, he's not even going to accept full responsibility of his terrible actions.
There's like three times in the comic where it it tells you on the page, like, stop reading. This is the end. You don't need to read any farther because the rest of the story doesn't matter. And I've never, that's like fucking crazy to have that in a book. Like, you wanted them to turn the page. You want them to get to the ending. So it's like, as a reader, you are insulted. You're told not to do things. You're made an accomplice to murder. You know, it's funny. They say great characters are, you know, made by their faults. A great character has many faults. And I think even that is a commentary here. Cause Henry Henry has too many faults.
Henry Henry is,
he has
awful.
No redeeming characters. Yeah. And that's, yeah, he's so hard. You can't connect with him. Even later when you find out about, you know, his past trauma, you still can't like feel bad for him because he's just a fucking murdering piece of shit and a thief and a fraud.
Yeah, like, I definitely agree with you about the great characters have those faults, but they become great in overcoming them or in mastering them or conquering them in some way. And in this, every fault is like a different crevice that Henry falls in, and then it's starting to climb out. And as he's like finally like tricks somebody into it, he's just right back into the next one, like just a never-ending series of trenches that he's fucking just crawling through. Yeah, he is one faulty. Well, I was going to curse right there. He's one faulty alliterative word. Faulty fucker. There we go. I'll just say it.
It's kind of hard to get behind such a son of a bitch, but it's worth it for how intelligent and creative this story is.
It has so many importance in threes when we get the William Blake reference with the tigers, which are also referenced to the echo spirits that are actually just a subconscious of Henry Henry. which makes me think that they possibly, I mean, every time you read it, you get something new from it. Me and Blake have discussed this, that
I think they confront Jill
Tiger Gang,
point, though,
those three,
they?
Are actually just a figment of his imagination. But
okay.
They do confront Jill, but that's when it's known as the Echo Spirits. Which the Echo Spirits are, which are actually Henry Henry, are basically trying to, you know, get Henry's success, and also they're trying to get through the best way I can explain it from reading it, from what I can ascertain, is they're his subconscious and his, you know, darker qualities trying to get through the grave of the poets so that they have control over the Fearscape, which, you know, kind of, I think, comes into the end of the book with what happens to Henry and what the greatest of all fears is in this story.
I almost saw those three as id, ego, and superego. You have the heart, you have the loins or the legs, and then you have the mind that's supposed to elevate it all. So the balance between these three drives, especially as they reflect in Henry, or how they reflect in Arthur. So, like you were saying at the beginning, it's a case of mistaken identity, and Henry goes along with this because he wants to be acknowledged. He's so struck by the muse and by the idea that somebody's saying his name with such respect that he assumes the role of Arthur. So I didn't know necessarily that the Fearscape was reflecting for him, or if it was still in Arthur's mind, and that it's broken because Arthur himself is suffering from the ravages of Alzheimer's. Potentially. We're not sure. Henry's pretty unreliable. So
that was one of the fun parts about this, is how hard it is to pin certain things down. Like these echo spirits, like, are they him? Is the Fearscape, you know, part of their, is it somebody's mind? Is it real? But then you have the muse, who is part of this world, apparently. So it messes with you, like, constantly. What's real, what's not real? Oh, but this happened at one point, but this happened later. And it's contrasting for a reason. Obviously, to, as Chaz said, play into this unreliable narrator, and not just an unreliable narrator, the most unreliable narrator. There's no other narrator that has ever been this unreliable. Like, Deadpool comes off as a historical tour guide, like, compared to this guy. Like, it's ridiculous.
Todd Phillips is Joker, unreliable narrator number two.
I like how they even, like, cover up what some of the word bubbles are saying with things that are completely different. Like, what him in his mind is thinking people are saying, or wants you to think that people are saying, is completely off base.
And there's definitely some significance to that bar called the Blacksmith, which is also the only place those tiger guys hang out with. That's kind of where they, I wouldn't say confront Jill, that's kind of where they're, like, observing Jill, almost stalking her while she's going to see her father in the hospital. But there are things I love about the fantasy elements in the Fearscape. I love that the greatest of all fears, the original one, was just darkness, because early humanity was just, you know, afraid of darkness, like, until the creation of fire. This little things like that, and being a lit nerd, it's just so many. Not only does he shit on Alan Moore, he shits on Joseph Campbell, and that's the most go-to for any screenwriter, is just taking a hero with 1,000 faces and just making small. I mean, that's what George Lucas did to create Star Wars. J.J. Abrams probably could have gotten more from that if he maybe read a book.
He read the book of badass filmmaking.
He only reads mystery
boxes. The
book
of lens flare and loud sounds.
Lens flare and really bad editing.
The honorary J.J. Abrams ripping.
Do you think he read his son's Spider-Man comic? That's what I want to
think
know.
He helped co-write it.
his son, they wrote it together, yeah. Blake. Don't forget.
Hey, Dad.
They both wrote it.
How do you talk to girls? Well, tell me, son. How do you think Spider-Man would talk to girls? I don't know. He always had a girl. What if Spider-Man had a kid just like you? I guess I could figure that out.
clearly in our Spider-Man by J.J. Abrams tangent, which we should definitely do as a joke on here one day.
Forgive us, gentle audience, as we diverge from our main narrative. Once more to foray into the hot coals that we've dragged J.J. Abrams over before. That.
I mean, what's there to say about Abrams we haven't already said?
Well, he wrote a comic. Well, Jack, you might not know this, but he wrote a comic book with his son called Spider-Man, which was set in the future. And for some reason, Peter Parker looks like Keanu Reeves and has one
arm.
Well,
he got his arm ripped off by the bad guy in, like, issue one.
Did you finish it at all? Is that...
Isn't it still coming out?
It finally finished, but it took, like, almost 3 years because... Either J.J. Abrams'
genius
busy schedule
is timeless,
or how long
guys.
It took his son to write the story. My main qualm it's with beautiful. That is that...
Yeah, as Henry would say, you have to wait for the inspiration to strike, or for you to strike the inspiration, maybe.
The great things about, you know, White Noise and Ryan O'Sullivan and everything is everything's explained clearly, and there's, like, not missing any scenes. In that Spider-Man story, there's definitely missing scenes.
Whoa.
Because he finds out he's Spider-Man's son... finds a suit, and then the next frame is him web-slinging. Like, no, like, obvious training scene you've seen in any other Spider-Man origin scene. He finds a costume in a basement, puts it on, and then the next one he's like, woo! Time to impress my girlfriend!
That's kind of refreshing, though, that you don't have to go through the same thing over and over again.
Nothing's refreshing about that book.
I'll take your word for it.
That will be an April Fool's joke, along with Three Jokers and maybe some other books.
No, you can't play the April Fool's joke hand too soon.
Well, or some book. We have many options we're going to throw out there that we can do as an April Fool's joke. On that episode, I'm pretty sure Henry said he did want to guest star and have his own take on what was going on.
I'm very excited to hear that.
Well, we've got so long before April, the people will probably forget about it.
No. They're holding on to it, I bet. They're every listener out there right now just wrote down, like, Spider-Man by J.J. Abrams. Can't wait for it to
marked
get
it on their calendar
on April 1st. Oh,
tune in this week for Three Jokers and J.J. Abrams' Spider-Man.
We're going outside our usual panels to talk about some books that really let us down.
No one listens to it except the people that actually like those, and then we just get tons of it. They're like, all you did was talk shit on the best comic I've ever read in my life. J.J.'s a god.
Did you read Three Jokers? That's a fucking masterclass in comic writing. Maybe you just don't understand.
Maybe when you told me that there's people that were loving that, I was very, very about Three Jokers. I highly doubt people love the Spider-Man book. It's Sarah Pacelli and her, I'm not going to say the rumor about why her art takes long to do, but.
You got some hot
so
goss, bro?
Right, like, now. What's up? Like, you threw that lure out there, and it's just like it was one of those motorized ones or something. My fish is like, okay, I don't fucking chomp at that.
I'm gonna go in the Discord chat real quick, or no, I'll go on the chat on here. Where is chat on here?
While you're doing that part, I want to say that I really enjoyed the concept of the Fearscape, like. This idea of a, even if it's not the true magical place that it's envisioned in this book, but just this idea of our shared collective unconscious as we process what makes us afraid, as we process what we go through. And I think as we get closer to the end of talking about the story, it really becomes clear that maybe this Fearscape is something for Henry in a way, right? Or for Arthur, maybe even, to process some of what they've been afraid of this whole time. So I really liked the design of it, the layout of it, the esoteric rules of it. There's something about fantasy, especially the kind of fantasy that I imagine Arthur Proctor writes, where there's a very magical world with those nice sort of defined rules. there's always a muse, and she brings the storyteller, and they go to this place, and then after that place, they go and confront the first fear. After they do that, they're ready to go tackle with their great work, whatever it is that they have to go face and slay. So, it's just, I'm a sucker for that sort of, that fantasy.
It's also kind of funny, like, when you think about it, how, like, this is the,
inside
of a writer's mind. Like, this is, they're so much more important than regular people. There's this, like, thing beyond heaven and hell, and it's where stories happen.
And these stories impact the world like a giant rock in a pond. The ripples will be felt for generations until we're dead and it stills again, till the next person throws their big rock in the pond.
I think it's a big statement too on how all writers steal from each other too, as Henry is stealing. That, yeah, because so many of the characters and the authors brought up in this are people who are constantly, their ideas are stolen from. So, like, Shakespeare.
Like you were talking about with Campbell and that idea of the monomyth. Like, he makes fun of it. Henry shits on it at one point. The people, the monomyth, what did he say? Monomythic mythalists or something. It's something alliterative, but he's basically making fun of the monomyth journey that he himself is on.
And even so much of, like, people take from James Joyce, they definitely take from Shakespeare. I mean, the Lion King is just Hamlet. I mean, it's literally the same story, but just,
that's true,
with lions. And I mean, you can do that.
Hey, don't talk shit on Lion King.
I'm not talking shit.
Not on that or on Hamlet.
No, I know.
I'm just saying, it's Hamlet.
That was my favorite college lit course, was all about Shakespeare. We just read a bunch of his plays and dissected them and analyzed them. But most of the time, all I could think, well, I mean, like, in my fun imagining of Shakespeare, every now and again, I would try to read each character in a different voice. So I would have, like, Christopher Walken as Hamlet, or Shaggy as Richard the Fourth, Shaggy from Scooby-Doo, not the singer. Because, although I imagine that would have worked pretty well in Hamlet, too. Wasn't me.
It wasn't me.
Yeah. Also with Henry. Henry could be voiced by Shaggy. You're right. Wasn't me.
The escalation I love in this too is how many times, like, as a sociopath will do, he asks the audience to forgive him, while he then does a terrible thing again and then asks, "Forgive me again," and it really builds up to a point where, so he gets the book, goes the Fearscape, becomes a successful writer, and then basically his trauma from being, spoiler alert, molested for several years by Arthur Proctor, Arthur comes, and Arthur's so out of it he doesn't even really realize he's selling a book that he wrote. And then Arthur touches a young child there that comes to get a signature from Henry. And him losing it while the muse, for some reason, is walking in to Henry's book signing and discovers that he is, in fact, Henry and not Arthur Proctor, which leads to my culmination, I think, of this book, where he brutally murders the muse and just continues to say, "Forgive me, dear reader," while he's just brutally stabbing her. And so much before he brutally kills her, he says, "Forgive me, dear reader. She assaulted me. I had no choice." But then in the art, you can see he's literally grabbing her by the neck and holding her when she hasn't laid a hand on him.
And then, he's constantly just blatantly lying.
Or just a sociopath. And
that scene, the forgive me scene, was one of my favorite in the book because it's telegraphed so well.
Yes.
Almost in the beginning, not just that, but like in the beginning, they talk about the presence of the letter opener, and he even says, "It confused me." I haven't seen any post grace either of our doorsteps. Henry's talking about him and Arthur's, their neighbors. They haven't gotten any mail, save for a library note for a collection of Chekhov plays, but I think that hardly constitutes, and that's when he steals the book, but it's Chekhov's letter opener. So in my mind, they reference Chekhov's plays right by this weapon. And then in the next thing, that I remember screenshotting here as they're talking about Petrarch. They remove the image of Petrarch slaying the fear because he says, "We men of letters disregard the visceral thrill of murder." And then we see him engaging in that exact thing while also being horrified by it. So I thought the payoff of that was so well executed that I loved it. And also it's incredibly like horrendous to think of somebody killing literal inspiration.
You know, it's funny though when you think about it, because I was talking to Michael about this and went in the other day, and we were talking about, you know, storytelling in general and how the kind of humorous bit throughout this whole deal is he is a good writer. Like, he makes up all these lies, he tricks all these people, and he really does control his own narrative. As a great storyteller does. So the fact that he has to steal this novel is kind of weird. Like, he could probably write a good novel. And then we visually, like, as a symbol, he murders the muse. Like, I don't even need this muse. You're hindering my narrative. And so he, like, surpasses the use of a muse, which it's like, wow. So there's all these elements, like, saying this guy is a great storyteller while he...
What I kind of picked up off that was that, like, he was psychologically abused by Arthur, probably, and, like, told that he couldn't be a good writer and that he was, like, limited to being this interpreter or translator, when he actually was very talented. He was just, like, most likely abused.
Yeah, and then also the editor is probably getting the info from Arthur that, you know, he's untalented. I love the when he makes fun of foreshadowing, but then all those images he shows at the end of the first chapter are important, which are the letter opener, the tree, the baby crib, the pen, the dead end sign, which comes back later, and then terraforming. Also, I love how it's called terraforming, which it is also could be like terraforming, like creating an environment.
Or and perhaps also fearscaping. Like landscaping?
Yeah.
Well, yeah, that's what I got off of it, because terraforming is like creating like a...
Well, they do.
Yeah.
Well, they do. The landscape that's created is the fearscape. So, I mean, the terraforming could be the book that creates, you know, I also think it is terraforming the fearscape in all of these things. And then Art and him literally injecting himself into
it. The other point that I want to make just real quick about the fearscape and some of this, and eventually about the big revelation that we get about Henry. I just spoke a little bit about how well telegraphed the letter opener, the murder, the event is. And looking back, the moment that we get the revelation about what happened to Henry, there's so much other stuff in this book that is telegraphing a similar thing. When he's confronting the first fear, which you thought was of the dark, for him it's the light. He even talks about while the dark brought terrors such as the boogeyman, the closet, and the shadow on the creaky floorboard, it also protected me. So knowing that creaky floorboard, sleepovers at Arthur's house, things happening where he could hide in the dark, but if a light came on, that door opened, and this shadowy figure is there, like, there's just something about that working so well, I guess. Like, Henry for me was such a piece of shit that I just, like, I didn't see any of that when I was reading it. I just thought he was being expositional, kind of like he's a person that loves to hear the sounds and the words, and talks about alliteration and being alliterative and making all these things just sound so good together. So I took it as something along those lines. He was just speaking a bigger thing, but being informed by that ending really changes the preceding events of the book, I thought.
I took it as why his fear was the light is because of what happened to him coming to light instead of like the darkness. The abuse coming
instead
to
of
light.
A physical light, but like a... informational light. Yeah. And it could also be, in a sense, because like I was also saying, we don't know necessarily that the Fearscape does reflect the person who's in it as far as fears go, or if it's based off who the actual storyteller is supposed to be. So that could very well be Arthur's fear as well, that these things are going to happen.
I was kind of wondering if he's just like crazy and it's all in his head.
It could be too. It could be like Inception also. Maybe he's secretly asleep on a train and his four friends are trying to make him realize that he didn't kill his wife, that she killed herself. It's all just to get Leo to wake up, and Henry is him in limbo. No, I'm kidding. That one's way too far out there.
Or
everybody take your tinfoil hat off.
Or throw because that one, this is a trilogy.
Up, the one I just put on and you throw it away.
He's almost the representation of Ryan O'Sullivan, and all of this is just Henry writing a book. Because, spoiler alert for the second one, even though he says it in the beginning, he's dead in most of Dark Interlude. So, I mean, all of this could just be Henry alive writing this story, and we find that out in the third part of the trilogy, and all of it was just him writing this grand story, putting himself in it, and then creating all these characters that he can observe and kind of show the power of the audience and how much we create all the stories that we read and kind of make them live on through our love for them.
Oh, like some Canterbury Tales action, like a frame story. There's like stories around the story.
Yeah.
And it's all about the God, the writer, who's made this world in 7 days and said, let there be plot. And then there was.
We'll have to bring Ryan on to talk about this. I know he's going to listen since all of them have been listening. They're real pumped about us talking about their books. So I would
like that interpretation quite a bit, because I feel like Henry as a name definitely feels like a placeholder. So if he is a fictionalized version of himself, and it's Arthur Proctor, right? Proctor like teacher, or like giving him a test, if you will. Even so there's
so many interpretations,
things in that. Yeah.
And as the greatest of all Furies, yeah, who is the editor at one point, talks about how he's just an echo. He's a non-existent being, because he's just Henry. Like, he doesn't even really have a name. A Henry followed by a Henry.
Yeah. What does he say? No surname, no forename, or something like that?
Where the editor becomes the greatest of all fears, because that is his greatest fear. And I think I was saying before in our episode that we did record is that for many writers, the editor is their greatest fear, because they're going to come in and, you know... Luckily, Vault, with how amazing they are, they didn't get in there. Imagine this book being released by Marvel.
Jonathan Hickman would have to write it. I feel like he's the only like one that could like pull off something like this.
This would be the Jonathan Hickman rewrite of like Demon in a Bottle. It'd be Tony Stark confronting his darkest fear, and it'd be like a Kool-Aid man, but a vodka bottle. You know what I mean? And then at the end, he would have to partake of its blood in order to, like, conquer it, but he'd be back on the wagon.
Do you think Cantwell's going to have him get drunk and have an unwanted baby with Patsy Walker, and then he's going to...
No.
And then he's going to go and have to, like, kill the
Cantwell's
baby in the
crib
because he doesn't want a child? No, because Tom Brevoort would never let that fly in editing.
Yeah, that's true. Good old Akira Yoshida, though, he might. Oh, sorry, are we calling him Akira Yoshida? Or are we calling
killing
him
the Muse by his real name? Isn't quite killing a regular baby. It's still terrible, but like...
Oh, that was his explanation, is technically he's the infant because the Muse has been around for centuries. So that was just his, you know, try to justify what he was about to do.
That's one of my favorite parts of the book, I think, is when he's... Well, there's a couple, because it's not very comical, and a lot of times even in good literature, like it's some stuff when it's like this, it's got to make you laugh sometimes, or it gets a little heavy. But I really like it after the murder when he finds out the Muse is this new baby, and the baby's like bad, and it points at him, and then later when he's holding like he. The like biggest sin ever is to like drop a baby. He fucking drops the baby. It's So, I mean, yeah, man, like, just like right we talked about earlier, like a guy with too many faults, like you don't, you can get away with a lot of things, but you don't ever want to be the guy that drops the baby, man. Like, you don't come back from that. Like, they don't let you back in the house. You don't get to go to the dinner parties anymore. It's like, you're the guy that dropped the baby. You're not in that circle of friends anymore.
I would say if someone dropped my daughter, I would be very hesitant to ever have them be in my presence again.
I think the only thing worse would be murdering the baby with the letter opening.
Yeah, it's that fatherly instinct kicks in real quick. I get mad when the nurses flip her over too quickly. It's
rightfully so.
A bit much for me. I get pretty just that fatherly love, that father instinct kicks in, and then yeah.
They do handle babies weird, man. I've never really thought about that before, but yeah, like I remember when my sister was born as a kid.
No, these Russian all like holding nurses, her
and like
man,
being gentle, and like the nurses are like grabbing her by the ankles and like flipping her over, like putting just doop 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 doop. Yeah, it's a baby, guys. She's not gonna break.
Like, our daughter never cries, and when we had to go to her last appointment, the only good thing about it is she didn't notice her shot, but. This woman literally just flipped her over on her stomach so aggressively that my baby was bawling and she does not cry. And she was so freaked out that luckily she didn't notice the shot they had to give her afterwards. But they literally tossed it around like a football, these Russian nurses.
We're going to deliver 6 more today. It'll be fine.
Which I can only imagine how their own children are. I mean, maybe they are just raising them tough. Nothing against Russians. Just it's our baby. Come on. Show some decency.
That's how they almost took over America, man. They just flip them over and shit as kids, and then they grow up and influence American elections. It's fucking crazy. It's all a conspiracy.
I mean, they're doing their
took a turn.
They're doing their protests right now. It might be not turning around eventually, but who knows? It could keep going the same way that it's always gone with Putin for life. Maybe not. Boy, this took a hard left, huh? I feel like our car just skidded on the guardrail real fast.
I just have to applaud, though, is how much skill Ryan took into this, taking everything he learned from school and turning it into this massive experience as not only the reader experiencing it, but also just as, you know, novels, comics, every medium to tell a story, and he did such a great job. Whether or not you like Henry, or you know, you because it's not a pleasant experience to experience the book, but the way he does it is so brilliant and unlike anything I've ever read, and is why I'm in love with it. I think he does just a banger job of creating something, as he states in the very first page, something truly original, which he did.
I think he had an experience. I think a lot of people in writing programs have this experience. But so like my first advisor meeting at the end of my first year of grad school, and this woman, I learned so much from this woman, but she was very intense. And she was like, you know, sci-fi, it's all junk literature. You need to read real literature. Like you're studying too much crap. And she like really took a dump on genre fiction. And I feel like he may have had like a similar experience. Like maybe he mentioned like, I want to write comics. And they were like, comics isn't literature. What do you want to be, a joke? You're never going to write a comic that means anything. And he was like, hey, fuck you, buddy. I am. And he did. He was like, I will write high literature as a graphic novel. And he did. He did that.
And most indie comics are all high literature. They're completely original stories that are fantastic. And people like Bill Maher don't understand that because they only think of the big two. I mean, throw this shit in Bill Maher's face and have him read it, and then maybe he'll have a different perspective on comic books.
I think
books.
He would quit right after the first time Henry insults us as the reader. I think Bill Maher would go back on his show and then just be like, Henry, it's fucking terrible. I don't know what fun Bill Maher stuff.
But then I finished it, and I could have helped murder a baby, and I was all in it. Not saying Bill Maher wants to murder babies, but
we're not saying it, I guess.
Not saying, not saying, not really.
Yeah,
you
know what he gets up to.
You know where Bill Maher would have a good time going to? A compound. We know of a compound.
They had to get in.
And we somehow have to connect Bill Maher with Starlight Compost to get him on that compound, because I'm pretty sure Bill Maher getting naked in a sweat lodge may open some eyes for him. He may have some weird orgy, and you know, it might a dirty unshowered orgy, and it may change his perspective on many things.
I think HBO political talk shows mess with people's head. Like, remember Dennis Miller used to be cool? now he's a shithead.
I don't know if Dennis Miller was ever cool.
He was just a weekend update at the time.
He was good on Weekend Update, but I'm talking about his HBO show.
And then he hosted football. he was a sports commentator. But now he's like a for real like bootlicker Republican though now these days, I think.
Definitely.
You live long enough, or no wait, you die a hero, or you live long enough to get rich enough to be a Republican.
Yeah, the money's enough. Definitely involved, Chaz.
100%.
Money is definitely involved.
Yeah.
But it's so great to get to dive into all these guys. I posted the other day just about, I've never connected with a group of writers this much. Dane Waters really represents my punk rock side and my abstract vertigo side of going weird and having to think about it. Ram V really hits me with the emotional and artistic side of myself. Ryan O'Sullivan's definitely my college lit nerd self that wants to be analytical about just the process of writing. And Alex Pagnadell is definitely the weeb cyberpunk nerd of me and myself, and apparently good at horror too, because Red Fork was incredible. But it's really cool that we get to highlight all these Vault books. Vault are good people. Adrian Wassel and David Desoniak are really great guys. They've really helped support the show and support me just as a comic reviewer for like the last couple years, and I gotta give them a shout out. They both seem like really nice guys, and I'm tempted to go visit Missoula, Montana one day because it looks real pretty. And it'd be cool to kind of hang out with those guys and even get them on. I mean, I hope to get all White Noise members on one day very soon. Maybe sooner than later. But yeah, this is... I'm going to bring it up because we did record another episode. We might release it for a special one day where it was me and Blake kind of just deep diving about college literature. But Ryan O'Sullivan has really crafted such an experience with this book. It's an experience you take with the writer and his journey. And the one thing you can say about all these writers, they're so unique, and it's cool that they have outlets like Vault to release this book with no editor coming in. I mean, of course there's an editor, but no editor coming in like Tom Brevoort, which I'm surprised Jeff Lemire ever worked at Marvel again after that, because his stories with Tom Brevoort are basically terrible.
Well, was that like the X-Men run?
Yeah,
is that
extraordinary?
Yeah, he basically said he wasn't able to write it at all. That Tom Brevoort gave him the stories, and he said, you can do dialogue, but this is what we're doing with the characters. That's it. Don't do anything original. Which is, I couldn't imagine any of these guys getting on the Marvel train. Pagnadell did write that one shot.
Yeah, but everybody loved that one shot. I haven't read it yet because I haven't read Empire.
I liked it. I read none of Empire, and I enjoyed it just because it was very packy. Pack was doing his thing. I want to state something now too before we like do our closing statements and talk more about how, you know, we all really enjoyed this book and what Ryan did with it. Is I feel like there's this like common thread going online about especially Marvel fans that don't work at DC because of all the editorial problems. That's a bunch of bullshit. DC is like the only one hiring these really creative indie writers and kind of letting them do what they want to do with these characters. Because I've seen it with Future State, I've seen it with giving so many titles to Ram V, and obviously with Dan Waters on Lucifer. And I mean, Dan Waters is someone I would never usually think to say this, but then I read Superman Wonder Woman, and Dan Waters has written the best Superman in that book, even though it is John Kent, but he makes John Kent feel like Superman. I'm sorry, but get Brian Michael Bendis off that book, get Dan Waters on Superman, and I'll be reading every Superman issue, because it's crazy how well well he writes that he could have his punk rock, Dickensian tale, the picture of everything else, his abstract punk rock tale, you know, coffin bound, and then he can write Superman, the best that anyone's written him in years. So, besides Tomasi, I said Tomasi.
And King,
Tomasi.
My man, up in the sky.
Dude, up in the sky is the best Superman thing I've ever read. Ever.
Sorry. Like, you read All Star, though.
I go
right?
back. I go back.
Oh,
I go
yeah,
back.
Grant.
I read Grant. I meant in recent times, and I forgot. I did not of King. Up in the sky is literally the best Superman story I've ever read. So props to Tom King. Tom King also, if he wrote Superman, yeah. I would read it. I'm talking about current people that have writing Superman.
I feel like that Up in the Sky goes under-recognized.
Up in the Sky needs to be talked about when we do our... that needs to be on there. Because, no, Up in the Sky is the best Superman story I've also ever read. Where I was bawling in tears.
Ugly crying. Straight up ugly crying, reading this beautiful book. Just like, God damn
it. The last time I cried that hard.
The alien gives his life for Superman. Ugly crying, dude. That whole
the boxing
moment,
match, like everything. Sequence. Like, I couldn't believe it. But I haven't cried that hard at a book since Day Tripper. And Day Tripper, I cried like somebody in my fucking family died. it was brutal, man.
I think I may have cried more with Up in the Sky. Like, also, okay, so Tom King, Dan Waters, they fundamentally understand who Superman is as a character. Why are they not writing Superman? I mean, I don't know what deal Bendis has in place. And also, I can get that Powers book that you said wasn't coming out on Amazon right now for $14, which is weird that I don't know how retailers don't have it, but Amazon does. But I don't know what kind of weird deal with the devil Brian Michael Bendis signed.
Well,
or it's DC related.
He's all done with Superman. He's on to Justice League. We're getting
Pretty sure. And, you know, I'm actually excited for him on Justice
Who's
League.
Who's taking over Superman?
Phil Kennedy Johnson, I think. Is taking over one of the two. I don't know if it's both, but I think
cool.
he's on Superman proper, which should be good. I don't remember what's going on with that.
Okay, so Swamp Thing, the new Swamp Thing coming out, super pumped for with Rambi writing, and that's going to get a new number one. Is Justice League Dark one of the ones that's going to get a new number
one? No, it's going to be in. It's going to be B story in every Justice League. So like,
yeah.
No, not. No, it's not going to have it. It's not even going to be a title anymore.
Yeah.
It's only going to be
like,
the Justice
League. So I think Justice League's going to be more, like a dollar more, maybe.
Yeah.
And it's going to have more pages, and it's going to be a
big
story.
A lot of the DC books are about to go up in price. Future State is like their
comic
test
talk.
Market.
So my Justice League Dark subscription is going to get me Justice League then. Chess.
Oh, I'll put Justice League on there if you want. It wouldn't have automatically because if it's just the B story, there are some people that don't want to slog through the A to get to it. But
You said that I'd get back on Justice League after Future State. Sorry, comic talk real quick. But now you're saying that that's not going to even be a title.
Yeah, if Justice League Dark isn't going to go, what I'll do is probably send out like a big marketing email to all the Justice League Dark readers that just says the story continues in the pages of Justice League. Two stories for one low price or something to get everybody hyped and not remember that they're paying a couple extra dollars.
I don't care. I just want to read.
Then we'll put you down for it. I'm just like, if I copy everybody over, then we might end up with like 40 extra Justice Leagues that we don't need. So if people are like, nah.
But Swamp Thing is just Swamp Thing, right?
Yes.
That's just Ram
the Swamp
Thing.
He's finally got a solo book again. About fucking time.
We'll see.
It's gonna rock. And Ram's killing it on Catwoman already.
Should we get back to that middle part where we weren't talking about that.
No, we could keep. Well, if it's talking about white noise stuff, keep it. But if it's just us Ram, no. I mean, you know what? Keep it because we want people to know how to get Ramby's Justice League.
Yeah, that's true.
So, yeah.
Maybe cut out a little bit of
I want to do.
we're not going to copy people over automatically stuff or whatever. Trim me down a little bit.
So people don't know. But keep it in so Ram V fans know. So
sorry, dear readers, you do not get to learn about Chaz's email campaign for the comic shop.
Do a little final thoughts on this book that I think is a masterpiece, and then let's get into some white noise news because there's a bunch that came out this week. So my final thoughts is I think this is Ryan O'Sullivan's, you know, it's a trilogy. It's his master class meta-literative story about writing and about deconstructing all these writers that other writers take from, including Alan Moore, Joseph Campbell, James Joyce, William Shakespeare, William Blake. And I think it's such an awesome experience that we all get to interact as the readers. And I definitely recommend you reading it. If you haven't read it yet, get it, read it. It's definitely worth it. And on, yeah, that's my, I love it. Ryan, I think you did a great job. You clearly are very well educated, and it was really awesome to see what you did with this. And you really, really showed what you can do with the creative writing medium, and I applaud you for that.
My final thoughts on this, and you'll have to forgive me, dear listener, because I wasn't honest and forthright with you from the beginning. I did not like this book when I started it. I did not like Henry, and now I sound like Dr. Seuss. I did not like him in the can. I did not like him on my bed. So I really came around, though. I gotta say, not just talking with y'all about it and thinking about how much it takes to write. He so smartly writes somebody who is acting smart, or acting smarter than maybe he is, in a way that isn't... I don't really know where I'm going with this, but I liked the journey that I went on, and I liked the way that it ends and informs a reread of the story. I think if I read this again, I won't have the same sort of visceral hate for Henry that I had at the beginning. And I'm not that he's redeemed by any means, but it's a very well constructed exercise in storytelling and the nature that the symbiosis between story and reader, what we bring to it, what it gives to us, and how we're complicit in the tale it tells. So I liked it a lot more at the end than I did at the beginning.
I'll piggyback off Chaz and say, in regards to, like, if you're one of those people that's not like me and won't, like, run your bank account down to dangerous levels to just buy all the fucking books you want because it makes you feel better. But if you buy your comics a little more sparingly, you will get your money for this book. It warrants so many rereads. You will get more every time you go back and look at it. You'll get a lot more if you're lucky enough, like me, to be able to discuss it with these cool guys and bounce ideas off of each other, because that's what really opened this up to me was... It was kind of hard to get into. As I went with it, it got better, but it really blossoms when, like, you talk to people about it and get other ideas about it that you didn't realize, as well as rereading it. It's also going to be cool to think about it. As Michael said earlier, it's a trilogy when we get to look at these different parts, both individually and as like a communal whole kind of situation. It'll be cool to go back and look at it then. But yeah, if you've ever taken a college lit class, even if you haven't, you will find odd places that you connect with this narrative. It will call you out for the kind of reader you are. You'll get self-conscious about being a casual reader. It's not a little quick, superhero fun, bash 'em up kind of issue. You know, there's a lot going on here. There's a lot to think about. The art's beautiful. Vault is amazing. These writers are definitely worth checking out. It's different. That's the cool part about it. It's just different. You won't have read something like it before. I would even argue it's hard to call it reading. You actually become more of a participant. And it's cool. You know, it's worth checking out. I won't lie. I bought it digitally, and then I went and hunted down the trade just so I could have it on the shelf. So I bought it twice. You should buy it once. You should read it. You should follow us on Twitter and talk to us about it. We'd love to hear your thoughts.
You should buy it twice anyways. Double dip all the time.
Yeah. Yeah, I gotta say, it's like I mentioned earlier, it's hard to follow a book with a main character that's such a son of a bitch, but it's worth it for how creative and intelligent the book is. It's extremely meta, and it appears that they don't break the fourth wall, but there is no fourth wall to begin with. It's an excellent series. But yeah, it's not easily digestible.
It's definitely not easily digestible, but you'll never experience something quite like it. Blake's little blurb about it on Twitter well described it. So now we got some news because, I mean, I'm obsessed with White Noise. Like I said, I've never connected with writers like this. Real quick, Limbo is back in print, which is...
Get it!
I had it on digital for years because it was out of print, but now since Homesick Pilots is a massive success, they're printing it again, and I now have a digital and in print, which I pretty much have all of the White Noise books, as Blake was just talking about. And if they ever do hardcover releases, since they're all becoming more popular, I'll be following that train as well. So Limbo is now available. You can order it from your LCS. You can also get it on Amazon.
Get on that one. It's so good. It's 50s noir with an 80s VHS aesthetic. It's
soaked in neon.
Yeah, Dashiell Hammond by way of, like, not John Hughes, that's not right, but, like, it's got such a fucking sick vibe. Like, when that was coming out, I loved it. Just, like, I wanted to try and wring it out onto me almost. You know what I mean? It was so cool, I wanted to just, like, keep experiencing it. So, I'm fucking stoked that that's
And that, that's the first book he knocked out of the park. You could tell the talent right there. It's also kind of like a Dark Night of the Soul, Voodoo Dark Night of the Soul as well. And it's funny. It's action-packed. There's weird fishmen and ancient gods lying around. And it's just, there's, you know, also you can get the best lizard on a stick there as well.
I was just thinking about Fearscape. We forgot to talk about when they mentioned Lovecraft and Poe.
Oh, that's at the beginning. That's so good.
I forgot.
Yeah. Lovecraft always getting thrown there also. Okay, so quick, now, new White Noise announcements. Everyone here, we obviously love Ram V, and TA did two Friday announcements. He's been teasing two new projects, one Vault, and the other one from another publisher, which he did say he hadn't worked with before, which will now bring me to my next part, which I thought maybe was Image, because he only did the OGN, but his actual first book... It's called Paradiso, which is printed by Image, which we will be doing to get back on that in a special episode on Paradiso in the future. And probably around what I'm going to talk about now is Ram's two new books have been announced. They both come out in April. The one that is currently in my background that they're all looking at here on Zoom is called Radio Apocalypse. And it's about after the apocalypse happens. Music's kind of been destroyed, but there's this radio DJ that's been playing the hits and kind of the last living radio station. And a new guy moves into town. His name is Ryan, I believe, but it's spelled Iron. And he develops a relationship with the DJ and they decide to make a band. A band at the end of the world to kind of bring music back. And it is drawn, colored, and inked by Anand R.K. And the little art snippets we've got of the panels look absolutely gorgeous. Man, his art has grown. And it is, of course, lettered by Aditya Bidikar. And that comes out April 5th. And then 2 weeks later, his other book he's been teasing is called The Many Deaths of Layla Starr, which He is drawn, which is drawn by Felipe Andrade, who's also doing the colors and inks, and once again, lettered by Aditya Bidikar. And it's set in a future Mumbai where technology exists that if you die, you are then basically put into a new body, a husk with your consciousness. And it's going to be a cool futuristic companion piece to Graffiti's Wall, which will be, I'm really excited about. And that, I believe that comes out 2 weeks after Radio Apocalypse. And we'll definitely be covering both those books when they come out. And probably most definitely his Swamp Thing run. And maybe do some short episodes talking about his Future State work, because his Swamp Thing Future State and Catwoman Future State are pretty rocking. One other thing is, we'll definitely have miniseries for all these creators. My next pick, which is quite down the line, is going to be Dan Waters. And why don't we do some announcements now? The next creator that I picked, which will be with Fantagraphics, is Cy Spurrier. And the publisher spotlight will be on Fantagraphics. And then Blake, who did you pick? To follow that up,
I think we're gonna do Tom King. Unfortunately, he doesn't have a lot of indie stuff, but Sheriff of Babylon, I think, has enough to say, and we can go into Mr. Miracle and Up in the Sky, and maybe even dip our toes into the Batman life in Gotham. And I think also we're gonna do AWA, which I think has plenty to choose from. They've been real solid lately.
I think we gotta do Batman, even if it's just like an overview of it, just because that's such an original Batman, you know, deep dive. And then we'll have Chaz's next pick, and then it's definitely Dan Waters for me, so we could get into Limbo and hope, you know, then by that time Homesick Pilots and the pitch of everything else will be completed. Any other news you guys want to do on this one? Any cool stuff you want to talk about that you read? I just read the penultimate issue of Seven to Eternity. Reminders, definitely someone will eventually talk about. And if you've been following that book series as a penultimate issue, it doesn't get much better than that. Whiskey Comics, who we all know on Twitter, said it's the best comic book he's ever read. I don't know if I'll say that. It's definitely the most beautiful comic book I've ever read. There are some scenes in this penultimate issue that Jerome Opeña has done that, oh my God, I understand it. I'm glad that they got caught up on this release so there's no delays, that it was already. But there are some scenes of absolute beauty at the Springs of Zal that I had to just stare at for like literally 3 minutes going, I can't believe an artist drew this. This is absolutely stunning. And I don't want to give anything away until people are caught up, but I hear that deluxe hardcover, when it comes, it's going to be mine. I think it's Rick's most complete work. It's his best work. And Adam Asaitis as a character, his journey as a character from beginning to issue 16 is, it's weird what you root for sometimes. And not only root, kind of fist pump going, yeah, because you know, some kind of the same way in Pulp,
where that was Pulp just ending, about to bring that I up actually, so for my news,
pumped, you know, but you know, like that ending of Pulp, you know, and the characters, you know, honesty with themselves. There's some great honesty that comes out in issue 15 and 16 of Adam Asaitis, and it just makes me love the character more. And there's a whisper scene in the near the end of this title, and it's kind of the way it's broken down to the friendship between Geralt and Adam is so great. And I can't wait for next month for it to finish up. I love Rick Remender. I've loved Deadly Class. I would have used to have said Black Science is my favorite book from him, but and Low, but both of those I don't feel like. Maybe it's because they went on too long, even though Lowe's only a few issues longer. But this thing, there's no downs at all on this. This is just it's a perfect series. And then all the Future State stuff I read this week, I really dug. Andrew Constant and Nicholas Scott made the best Nightwing comic in the last, that this I can say, the best Nightwing comic in the last, since Rebirth, by far. And it's one issue. It's one issue, and it's better. And is that who's taking over Nightwing when he comes back? No, it's so much better.
Are you ready? Hold on to your butts, because it's Tom Taylor and Bruno Redondo, the Suicide Squad Team Supreme, taking on that blue... chested man. I can't wait.
That
Nightwing booty.
You might as well throw that on that my pole.
Juicy butt Nightwing.
Nightwing is finally going to become relevant again.
Sorry for all the Rick defenders out there. We respect your opinion. Please keep listening to us.
I'll we're glad that Rick's got a nice ass too.
That made me stop reading Nightwing.
When they focused on his butt too much. Because that's mostly the internet.
No, but the Rick defenders, I did not know they were Rick defenders.
So tired of DC pushing their ass man agenda on me.
I know.
And I'm going to go into something real quick. DC has better writers than Marvel. I'm sorry. I was on a thread this week that Goose posted because he's a huge Cates fan. And all these people were basically saying, like, don't have them go to DC. It's a mess. They don't have great writers. And I just want to say to these fans of Marvel, you're delusional. Marvel has no good writers except Hickman and Cates. I'm not the biggest Cates fan. I know our buddy Goose loves him. I like a lot of stuff Cates has done, but he just got to stop narrating with that Texas accent. Crossover's been great, but, like, the one you feed... it's really cool looking, but then like it's narrated with like, and it's a fantasy world, but then he's like, and this is how we went down there with his Texas, drawl. His Texas narration. Y'all. I'm just like, Donnie Cates, it's a fantasy book. Why are you doing this narration in your fantasy book? Crossover's great though. I love God Country. I like Redneck for a large portion of it. He's a talented writer. Silver Surfer Black is absolutely amazing. It is a Trad Moore art, but it's also the story. Like, that got me pretty emotional. So, I mean, I like Donny Cates, but to all of you Marvel delusional fans, DC has, let me just go off it. Ram V, one of the best living writers today. Dan Waters, one of the best living writers today. Tom Taylor, one of the best living writers today. Tom King, one of the best living writers today. And that's just off the top of my head. Philip Kennedy Johnson, a fantastic writer. Marvel's got Jonathan Hickman and Chip Zdarsky and Rosenberg. And now they're both free agents, and Rosenberg is signing on and going to be doing a Grifter series and an Urban Legends. And I feel like Zdarsky's about to dip his feet in that pool, too. So when they lose Rosenberg and Zdarsky, they got Hickman and Cates.
Don't forget. Old Chris.
How would I forget Chris Cantwell? I love Chris Cantwell. I'm a huge Chris Cantwell fan, but I forget because he's newer to Marvel. His Iron Man run is great. Doctor Doom run is great. So
I loved it.
So let me go back. They have Hickman. They have Cantwell.
Oh, they got Cantwell, Al Ewing,
can't wait for Cantwell's vault book.
Benjamin, yeah, and Ben Percy.
Okay. Okay.
Let's put it this way: both companies have their highs and lows, and.
That's very.
And
yes,
whatever you enjoy, you enjoy. Okay, we're not yucking nobody's
yum. I'm not yucking nobody, but I'm not saying, but people will go on and say DC has terrible writers. Yeah. It's not true.
Yeah, no, it was an aggravating thread. I saw it. Part of me wants Don Cates to go to DC just because I think Don Cates is an okay writer. He's a solid writer. He's not my favorite. I respect everybody's opinion. His fans really, really like him.
Yeah.
So it's really hard to even like critique him a little bit and be like, well, I wish this would happen. He's like, don't ever say that on the internet. Hide in a corner, whisper it, write a note to yourself. That's fine. Just don't say it on
Wait
the
for
internet.
Somebody to walk away and whisper
it. Let me state this better. DC has a whole threshold of fantastic, some of the best living writers. Marvel does have Hickman. They have Cantwell. They have Zdarsky. They have Percy. They have Rosenberg,
Kelly Thompson, Al Ewing.
And a lot of these
KT power.
Yeah. Kelly Thompson. So good.
I respect your opinion. Whoa!
Cross the bow. Here we go.
Anyhow, Kelly Johnson.
I hope you're not litigious. No, I'm just kidding. We didn't say anything bad about you.
Kelly Thompson is a very well. She's a good writer. Nothing against Kelly Thompson. She's not my vibe. It's mostly just Hawkeye stuff. I never got over the Hawkeye stuff. She did a great West Coast Avengers run, so I love that. So yeah, Kelly Thompson too. But I mean, like, that's a handful of writers. But then they give books to people that I feels like have never written a comic before, which I don't understand, because these same people get jobs at Vault and do great. And also, I'm gonna get into Marvel representation right here of just their stock. Vault, amazing paper, amazing stock. Scout, amazing paper, amazing stock. Aftershock, their stock and paper gets better with every month. Image always has a good stock and good paper. DC's stock is incredible. Like, they have great paper. The paper that Marvel prints their comics on, and I'm sure it probably has to do with Disney, I could flip it like this and I'd rip the whole comic in half, because it's so thin, it's so cheaply printed, and there's so many errors on it. I'm a Marvel fan. Like, I was a Marvel fan growing up, and I got into DC. I absolutely loved Hickman stuff. I love Hickman stuff with X-Men. I'm getting that Ten of Swords omnibus. I've loved what Zdarsky has done with Spider-Man when he's writing Spider-Man, and when he's had his, you know, his touches of Fantastic Four. I love the artists in Marvel, Pepe Larraz and Arbe Silva. Arbe Silva becoming the regular artist for Fantastic Four makes me almost want to jump back on it, because it looks fantastic. But my main point is, I would never go on a thread and say, like, don't work for Marvel. All their writers and team are shit. Which is what someone said on a thread. I know Blake knows what thread I'm talking about. And I just won't participate in that and say anything. But I mean,
You know you're a real nerd when you can go that deep on the paper quality.
but I'm all about paper quality.
He's right, though. Like, I buy all the X-Men. Excuse me. I buy all the X-Men, and I love the X-Men comics, but I'm very careful when I read them, because I'm like, don't fall apart. I really hate it when
Don't work for Marvel. Their paper's shit.
I don't even think it's real paper. It's some kind of fake paper.
It's the new pulp material. I feel like they designed it to be like, this is a consumable. If you could keep it nice, good job.
And they just seem like they do more cash grabs too, like Marvel. As Blake pointed out the other day, Giga sales, you know, launched. So now they're doing Avengers Mech Assault. What?
But then they put out that Nakayama variant, and I'm like, well, okay, I'll buy it. it's so beautiful.
Really cool. Yeah, DNA is so good.
Comic company coming out called Bad Idea that Chaz introduced me to, which I'm definitely going to get excited about that. Yeah. It looks awesome.
There's one about a whale. There's a whale one shot. Like, it looks cool. It's by Matt Kent.
It was like years ago. I can't remember who wrote it, but it was called like Gutsville. It had Fraser Irving art, and it was about this like Puritan town that got swallowed up, and they live inside a whale.
I love Fraser Irving. Fraser Irving has my personal email, because I always get his indie books. He also, real quick shout out, Fraser Irving.
It was Simon Fraser Campbell. Spurrier.
I'm getting them mixed up now. But anyhow, Vault has a lot of cool books coming out this year. They have that new Ram V book. They have the Picture of Everything Else right now. That's incredible. It's maybe going to be how it's going right now, it might be my number one for 2021, battling it out with Homesick Pilots, and now battling it out with these two new Ram V books coming out. Well, it's going to be real hard. It's going to be a hard fight between Homesick Pilots, A Picture of Everything Else, and these two new Ram books, because both that Andrade art and, man, Radio Apocalypse looks incredible, especially with how Anand is, you know, really pushes art back. And quick, Vault, because they got too many orders, pushed back the second issue of The Picture of Everything Else to February 17th, because Dan Waters is finally becoming the writer he deserves and popular, and I don't think they expected to get a huge amount of orders for The Picture of Everything Else. I don't know. Did Image expect Homesick to blow up the way it did?
I hope so.
They weren't. It hasn't been hard getting variants and stuff. They haven't sold out.
Yeah. And Image has got that really nice, they offer returnability, I think. So
they're doing,
you could take a real
deep
chance.
They're doing well enough
stuff.
That they reprinted a 5-year-old book. So it's doing well enough. And on Tumblr, where we're on, Homesick Pilots is a very popular trending tag. So, I mean, hopefully that's people that are actually buying
it. It should
the comic
be. It's that comic's
true.
Fucking boss. Hopping back to Ram real quick, though. Like, I think we should, and I hope all our listeners listen to me, even like double listen to me right now. Ram is about to have a massive year, and anything he puts out, you should put on your pull. I buy some variants. Like, keep this stuff around. Like, he's about, this is where he's already a great writer. Like, he's already like shown his chops, and he's, you know, so I heard a waitress say this one time when our GM was going off on it. She was like, oh, he's just putting his dick on the table. Ram's dick is on the table. Like, it's going to be a huge year for him. He's got all these great books coming out, and this is really where he's going to take off. I think. Like, I think this is going to be the year where everybody really starts noticing him, and he's going to be this new household name that's going to get some big gigs. With, you know, he's already got solo titles with DC that are doing well. But yeah, I just he's going to be one to like just buy everything and buy a variant and hold on to it, and it'll be worth it.
I can't wait to see what Ryan releases next after he's done with this trilogy. And for Marvel, get, as Blake suggested to me, get Ryan O'Sullivan on Deadpool. Guys, imagine that Deadpool. That'll be a Deadpool that'll go bonkers for sales, because I think he would do a great job on that character. And since Packy is, you know, obviously flirting with Marvel, give Packnadel something cool with Marvel. Give Alex Packnadel Moon Knight.
I'd buy that.
I would buy that too. Give Packnadel Moon Knight, and maybe if it happens, we'll predict it, and then I'll be back on Moon Knight. That's a little white noise news. This is our white noise vault spotlight. So we want to once again, quick vault update. We mentioned the picture of everything else getting delayed to February 17th. Also because of orders, Giga number 3 has been delayed to March 3rd. And I know that me and Blake are crackheads for Giga and their variants. So we got to wait now till March 3rd.
But every day, that just means good every month. Day I think about buying that $100 vault variant. There's still
just
30.
Good months.
There's still 30 of them.
This month we get Dark Interlude number 3. In February we get the picture of everything else number 2. And then in March we get Giga. And then in April we get the Ram V Radio Apocalypse. So we got a bunch of good months of vault white noise books coming ahead of us. And our next episode on our white noise deep dive will be on Frendo by Alex Packnadel, drawn by Martin Simmons, and that will be our very good friend Joe Paquette will be joining us for it. Very excited to talk about it with him. And then we're getting a double release this week, guys. We're gonna also release Catwoman by Ed Brubaker, which I can't wait to talk about. And as always, thank you all for listening, and I am Michael, also known as Poet Air. You can find me on Twitter at PoetAir33. Blake, where can they find you?
You can find me on Twitter and Instagram at BTMorgan85.
And then Jack, our dutiful, strongest worker editor, where can they find you on Twitter and other social media?
You can find me on Twitter at @sin_aesthetics with an X, or on Instagram as sinaesthetic. And SoundCloud, I'm going to be putting out a new track because I'm also a musician this weekend. So check that out.
Check it out and tag it in there. Nice. And of course, my always co-host that helped conceive this project that we are having such a blast doing. Where can they find you, Chaz?
You can find me on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook at Chaz Simons with no dot, space, or anything else.
And as always, as Mike go out, please, people, we're in tough times. Hopefully good days lay ahead.
Oh, hold on. Before we do that, I was going to say, make sure to follow us on Twitter at Outside the Panels. We are at Outside the with a O at the beginning. We're also getting more stuff up on YouTube, Tumblr, and all sorts of other places. So everything you can find, though, through our Twitter there, and then find links to everything else right there. Keep up with us and all the cool stuff.
We are on Twitter, we are on Tumblr, we are on YouTube, and now we are listenable on at iTunes, where most of you get it. We are also on Spotify. We are now on Amazon Music, and we are actually on. Hold on, I'm gonna pull this up real quick because I have it. Because there's some I've never heard of, so I'm gonna let you guys know. We are also available to be listened to on. One moment. We are also available to listen to on Overcast, Podcast Addict, and if you subscribe to those podcast apps, we are also available on all of those. And as Chaz said, we are outside the on Twitter with a zero up front. And please, when you listen to our podcasts, please write, review, and subscribe. We appreciate all you guys, and we're in strange times. We just got a new president. Hopefully, we'll be through this plague by the end of this year. Let's fingers crossed. Let's get that herd immunity. Go get vaccinated. And while we're dealing with these tough times, please be good to yourself, be good to others, and you know, show that love and empathy. Always think of anyone else of being in your shoes. And Chaz, as always,
stay safe and wash your hands.
Thank you for listening. This is Outside the Panels. Have a great day.